I'm Nick Harvey Doyle, an Anawan man from the northern tablelands of New South Wales. The Yarn podcast is made on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri, Woiwurrung, and Bunurong people. We'd like to acknowledge First Nations people as the first storytellers. We pay our respects to elders past and present. Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land.
From the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne, this is The Yarn. I'm Thomas Phillips. According to an old urban myth, a frog suddenly dropped in boiling water will instantly leap out to safety. But if the water is tepid and gradually heated, the oblivious frog will slowly boil to death. This process is a metaphor for human psychology, especially when it comes to ecological decline. Over time, gradual change can make unprecedented catastrophes feel normal. This week, we're bringing you stories about revolutionary attempts to reverse these abnormalities, from resurrecting extinct species to unlearning the colonial mindset. It's the fifth episode of Not Natural, a series about the tension between the natural and the artificial. These stories were produced for the Science Gallery's new exhibition, Not Natural. It's open now and includes a listening station where you can hear work from our students. First up, ancient fungi roots are a biodegradable alternative to plastic. Fergus Sinnott reports on their potential to reshape the design industry.
From the very beginning of architectural history, humans have been working with largely unsustainable materials. But as our society tries to move towards a more sustainable future, the industrial design industry has been returning to its roots to make use of one of the oldest organisms on the entire planet. That organism is mycelium, the root structure of a mushroom that grows underground. It may look like a bunch of interwoven spider webs and feel rubbery in your hands, but it's beginning to be used to produce food, product packaging, and even furniture.
We don't think of the mycelium as much because it's not as visible to us just because it's beneath the surface, but it's a much, much bigger part of that organism than the mushroom is itself. The largest living thing on the Earth is a mycelial network in North America. The oldest living thing on Earth at the moment is a mycelial network.
This is Jake Shaw, an industrial fabricator and lecturer in interior architecture at the University of South Australia. Jake contributed a piece to the upcoming I'm Permanent exhibition here in Melbourne, which foregrounds mycelium, its potential to change the face of the design industry, and to strengthen the relationship between humans and the environment.
If a metric for how developed a species is the opportunity that it's had to evolve and adapt to its environments, then mushroom mycelium, and indeed mushrooms, fungus of all kinds, goes absolutely unparalleled. It's been around for that much longer. It's survived every cataclysmic event on the face of the Earth throughout history.
Jake has created a dining chair from a combination of fabricated steel and mushroom mycelium. The aim was to take a piece of furniture that is so integral to our daily lives and combine it with a material that is integral to our environment.
It's supposed to speak to ideas of domesticity. It's supposed to speak to ideas of memory and sort of just subtly echo the sort of chair that somebody might remember from their grandmother's house or something like that. So, if there's anything I hope people take from this exhibition, it's to be inspired by mushroom mycelium as a material, as a vision of the material future, but maybe more so than that, to just walk away with a sense of awe about everything in the world. Because if you find the mycelium exhibition interesting, you should find every single material in your life equally interesting.
That was Fergus Sinnott. They've been extinct since 1936, but genome editing could bring the iconic species back to life. James Atalia-Prasad on the demise and possible de-extinction of the Tasmanian tiger.
While animal de-extinction might sound like the stuff of science fiction, it may be closer to reality than once thought. In fact, we could soon see it in our own backyard. Known as the Tasmanian tiger for the distinctive dark stripes on its back, the thylacine was a carnivorous marsupial native to the forests and grasslands of Tasmania. However, as Tasmania's economy grew increasingly dependent on the sheep industry, the canine-like creature was blamed for predation and stock losses, and became the target of large-scale government hunting bounties in the late 1800s. By the early 20th century, excessive hunting and introduced disease alike led to the population's extinction, with the last thylacine dying in 1936. Since then, the Tasmanian tiger's existence has been the subject of much speculation.
In the news is the Tasmanian tiger. Reports in recent weeks have revived hopes that a few of them still survive out there somewhere, but the sad fact is, we'll probably never see another.
However, a de-extinction research group at the University of Melbourne's Tiger Lab is working to bring the thylacine back to life.
I'm an evolutionary morphologist and comparative anatomist.
Associate Professor Christy Hipsley is a research collaborator in this project, which in 2017 published the first entire thylacine genome.
A pouch young specimen called C5757 was preserved well enough that some of its DNA was intact. From this, our team was able to extract these short fragments of DNA and reconstruct the thylacine genome.
But as she explains, there are still hurdles to surmount.
So now we have two challenges to deal with. One, we have thylacine DNA, but no viable cells. And two, even if we could insert thylacine genes into a surrogate cell, who would that surrogate be?
After partnering with American biotechnology company Colossal Biosciences last year, the lab estimates these technological challenges can be overcome within the next 10 years. Nonetheless, ethical questions remain about the thylacine's de-extinction. For one, this methodology has raised considerable debate about the biological authenticity of the reproduced species. Bioethicist Dr. Christopher Lean explains.
Introducing thylacine DNA into a nearby related marsupial can never truly bring back the species in all of its details. So I think that we need to be honest about the identity of the population created.
More broadly, there are concerns that a biological veto like de-extinction could result in dangerously lax treatment of the natural environment.
If we view extinction as being something that can be overcome, we run the risk of future generations believing that they can lose species and then simply bring them back.
Indeed, as biotechnological expansions continue to bring us closer to this enigmatic marsupial, the question of whether we'll see a thylacine in the flesh may not rest on whether we can make one, but rather whether we should.
That was James Atalia Prasad. In our next story, Liliana Jacques interviews Jack Mitchell about the devastating aftermath of colonial waterway engineering.
It's the desire to dominate and the lust for power that has resulted in the way that we treat water. My name is Jack Mitchell and I am an artist, a designer, researcher. I have Whadjuk, Balladon and Yuwud Noongar connections. Being drawn to do this work feels like a duty, a responsibility to heal our relationship with country. And so this is my origin story for water. C.Y. O'Connor was the Irish engineer. He was brought in basically because they were building a new rail network and they needed ships to come in because of gold. And quarry the rocks that were used to form the groin, the North and South Mole groin at Fremantle Harbour. And this was just after I had initially dynamited the sacred limestone embankment that separated the salt and the fresh water at the mouth of the river, of the Derbul-Yergin. And this salt and fresh water separation was sacred to the Noongar people because it guided life on the plain. The bodies were this pattern, were this relationship. And then built a pipeline to take the water from there, 500 kilometres across the dry desert, to provide water for the gold mines. And so blackfellas had no interest in mining gold, no use for it. You know, you leave that stuff in the ground, that's just, there's power in that, and leave the power in the earth. And there was water to be found in the desert if you knew where to look, but see where O'Connor came with that colonial mindset, that engineering mindset, that enlightenment, technology, dualism, separation, control. The story goes that he was sung by the elders. So the elders got together and agreed that he had done too much damage to the most sacred, you know, that the water is sacred. That's the rainbow serpent. That's the creator spirit. That is how, that is us. It's what we need to survive. It's fresh water. It's food. It's everything. You know, shortly after he was sung, he rode his horse down into the water at the, what is now known as Seaway O'Connor Beach, and shot himself in the head. And that's what happens when you get sung, you get sent. Kartwala. When I go back to Perth, I can feel this water is sad. It's sad, you know, like the water is unhappy. And for what reason? For what reason did we chase gold? So that we can own gold as a metal, as a thing of value in life. Can be felt and experienced and understood with it remaining in the ground.
That was Liliana Jacque interviewing Jack Mitchell. Next, another story about the value of Aboriginal knowledge. Zuva Gavira interviews a tour guide about Indigenous land preservation.
Nature deficit disorder. Psychoteratic syndromes. Disconnection from the natural world is a rising issue so prominent that a whole new lexicon is emerging to describe it. But, here in Australia, there is much to be learnt from our First Nations people about reconnecting with the land.
You know, Indigenous Australian cultures, there's so many. There's like 270 different languages prior to colonisation. With each of those languages, we have different cultures and histories. But the fundamental part of most of these cultures is the connection to country and nature.
This is Sam, a Wiradjuri woman studying Indigenous cultures and history at Monash University and a tour guide at the Koori Heritage Trust.
I grew up not on country, but I grew up on Wurundjeri country, and it's always been something that I've grown up knowing, that you take care of country and you take care of the nature and the land and it'll take care of you.
Taking a tour with Sam a few months ago, I walked along the Birrong Ma and was struck by the artworks that line the river. Upon further inquiry, I would learn that these pieces pay homage to a custom in many Indigenous cultures that aids in the preservation of the land.
Totems are such an incredible part of a lot of the different Indigenous cultures that we see around Australia. There's a lot of different nods to the totems on the Birrong Ma, the most notable being done as a 2006 art exhibit for the Commonwealth Games by three women of the Kulin Nation. A lot of the time you'll have a personal totem, a family totem, and then a larger maybe tribe totem. That's a responsibility given to you that you don't hunt that animal, and a lot of the time you take care of the land so that animal can thrive. It is one of those things that it isn't just seen as animals and nature being tools and produce and resources for you, but also part of you and part of your connections. Being connected to nature is so intrinsically part of your identity when you're both Indigenous and even just in Australia. So if you can take a moment to step back and acknowledge that everything around you is alive, and therefore respecting it that way, is one of the major steps to, you know, respecting country and understanding the core points of a lot of Indigenous lore.
That was Zuva Gavira. A massive thank you to producers Simon Sinnott, James Atalia Prasad, Liliana Jacque, and Zuva Gavira. If you'd like to hear more work from the Centre for Advancing Journalism, check out The Masterclass, a podcast where Louisa Lim interviews some of Australia's best journalists about their craft.
Every story that you do, you need to talk to people. And I think that's what separates the work of an opinion writer compared to the work of a journalist who is reporting on news.
My boss was really scary and they were just like, go and find someone to talk to who's there. And I was like, how am I meant to do that? You know, everybody's in the sea.
It's broadening this remit of interviewing from just a Q&A to the groundwork that happens before, and that's not just about writing up questions, it's about developing a rapport with your interview subject.
If someone says they don't want to be interviewed, when do you push and when do you just kind of let it go?
I'm persistent.
I know you are persistent. That's why you work for us.
I'm Julia Bergen, a reporter based in Mbantwa, Alice Springs, and the former Northern Territory correspondent for Cracky. In this episode, I'm going to give you a masterclass in finding interviewees.
That was a taste of the Masterclass podcast. You can subscribe by following the link in our show notes. The yarn is from the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne. It's produced on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Our executive producer is Louisa Lim. I'm Thomas Phillips. See you next week.